Hello, this is Robert Kiyosaki. This is a continuation of the audio tape educational program for Cashflow Investing 101. Today I'm in the studio with a very dear friend of mine for years. What I always say is always hang around people who are smarter than you, and Bill Shopov is in the area of investing, accounting, as well as real estate acquisition. I think he's one of the smartest guys around that I know of. He's one instrumental in helping develop the board game Cashflow. I mean, he played it when it was just a butcher block piece of paper and we were trying it out and experimenting with it. So it's with great pleasure I have Bill Shopov here. He is going to be talking about some of the fundamentals of real estate investing. So welcome, Bill. And to start, would you mind giving people a little bit of your background, where you come from, and how you came to become a real estate investor in the world?
Thank you, Robert. Pleasure to be here with you today. I have been involved in the real estate business since, started in around 1980. Before that, I had gone to the University of Texas, gotten a master's degree in accounting and finance. And while at the University of Texas, I started selling residential real estate as a way to get myself through school, and bought my first rent house shortly after going to school, just right after graduating, bought the first rent property, and have continued that for the last 20-plus years.
How much was that first property you bought? Can you remember that?
I think it was about $42,000, and I bought a 1/3 interest with two other real estate partners of mine, two other real estate brokers that I officed with.
So starting at $42,000, how many millions or maybe billions of dollars have you done, you think, or been responsible in transactions?
Well, our firm now to date has been involved in transactions that we've actually acquired over $300 million worth of real estate and have been involved in over $1 billion worth of transactions.
So starting with $42,000, that's how the progression went.
That's correct.
And each time, did you learn something new?
Each and every time I go to a new deal and I learn something different about it. It's a continuing learning experience, and I think that's one of the reasons why I do real estate. I like being challenged on a daily basis. There's a lot of similarities between each deal, but then there's enough differences just to keep it interesting.
But also in your background, you were telling me while you were in college, you were doing stock and trading and other types of investment, you know, procedures.
That's correct. Actually, when I was in graduate school at the University of Texas, I had taken my student loan and invested it in commodities and stocks. Did quite well with it. Over the course of about 3 months, I parlayed $5,000 into about $90,000. And then I had a massive learning experience, and that $90,000 became minus $5,000. And to that, I took some great learning. And the main thing is I learned you have to get back in the game.
That's correct. And for those who know that what Bill will be doing on this tape is the basics, the fundamentals, is primarily for people who are just getting started or considering getting started in the area of real estate. He's also an occasional instructor when I can get him out of his busy schedule to come and do more advanced instructing or teaching at the live seminars we put on, and Bill goes into some of his more sophisticated types of real estate acquisition, holding, and selling of properties. And then he's also on my financial literacy tape where he goes into greater depth. So for those of you who are interested in the idea of making real estate investing one of your investment vehicles, then you'll have an opportunity through our organization to interact or meet with Bill on different times and different ways. So today we're just going to stay in the very simple, the basic ideas of real estate investing. So if we could go back, when did we meet? It's been in the 80s, wasn't it?
I think we probably met in the late 80s or early 90s, Robert, at one of your, the first time we met, it was at a seminar that you'd done, Powerful Presentations. But I think probably the first time we really got acquainted was at a Creating Wealth seminar that you put on.
Right. And I know it's not the most pleasant subject, but how was your investment career going at that time when we met?
Well, I had declared bankruptcy a year or two probably prior to that, and I think I was at an undoubtedly economic low point in my life, had lost all my money, had also lost my relationship and was recently divorced, and then in a new relationship by the time I'd met you, Robert. But, you know, from an economic standpoint, things weren't at their brightest level, but we saw opportunity on the horizon.
That's correct. And the reason I bring this up is because here's Bill. He's probably one of the smartest financial, I put my money with Bill and his company. A lot of times, what do I invest in? I said, I trust Bill Shopoff with my money because his accounting records, his integrity, his ethics, his morals are impeccable. But I can always get straight answers from him on how our investments are going, and his returns are excellent. But the point of bringing this up here is here's a guy who is formally trained, very bright, and even when the real estate market went down in Texas, as it did in many parts of the country after the 86 Tax Reform Act, even the brightest get caught in that down cycle. And I've said many times in my books and tapes that sometimes those are the best times because that's when we learn the most. But also, where I was asking this question, would you like those times to come back again? I mean, were they some of the best times also?
Well, I mean, from a real estate opportunity standpoint, I mean, I could remember going to an auction with for HUD foreclosure houses.
That's HUD stands for
the Housing and Urban Development, which is a division of the U.S. government that insures mortgages for single family and duplexes primarily, but also gets into larger commercial properties. But we were there simply on behalf of some clients who were trying to buy some homes, just houses to live in or for investment. And I remember the auctioneer, the gentleman for the government who was reading the auction bids, mentioned that a duplex in Austin, Texas was selling for $18 a square foot. And I kind of scratched my head and realized that I knew that was, you know, less than half of what it cost to build that duplex. And in fact, at that auction, we saw properties sold for less than we had previously sold the land for before they built the duplexes on that land. So we saw a great opportunity, and with that, we really jumped in and really changed our business at that point.
Right, and the reason I bring this up is one of the main reasons people don't invest, or I would say are average investors, is they're so afraid of the economy changing or things going bad or losing their money, and not that we recommend it. Yet, Bill and his wife Cindy live in a city called Austin, Texas, where a guy named Michael Dell lives. And at the same time as the economy was crashing, Michael Dell was coming up. And today, Austin, Texas real estate, I mean, is so expensive as we're now past the year 2000. But when I met Bill, they were giving that stuff away for free. And that's why I'm saying to people is many times people don't invest because they're afraid of losing. So they don't do anything. And when the economy goes bad or gets good, they're out of the market. They're out of the loop, should we say. And so instead of being afraid of the ups and downs of all markets, whether it's stock market, mutual funds, or real estate, is that it's your education that actually gets you ahead in the game. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think definitely. I think, and I think it's a combination of formal education, if you have one, but I think it's more importantly your day-to-day education. It's the education you get from staying in the game. It's the education you get from reading books, education you get from working with your friends and mentors.
Right.
Those are the things that I think are important to me to continue to sharpen your skills in whatever investment category you happen to choose. Mine is real estate, but I think there are plenty of other places for somebody to get ahead financially.
Right, but you're also not only in real estate. I mean, what we were talking about earlier is the principles or the fundamentals of investing remain fundamentally the same. Would you agree with that one?
Oh, absolutely, Robert.
Right. And real estate is, so let me ask this question. Given you've had experience in stocks, bonds, startups, you know, big companies, small companies, and real estate, I asked you this question earlier, why do you stay in real estate?
Well, real estate is my primary passion. I like it because I can create value, not just add value or take advantage of a rising market, but I have been doing this long enough that I can spot niche opportunities where I can truly create value, instantaneous increase in net worth.
For those of you who are listening to this tape and my books and things, the third book, Rich Dad's Guide to Investing, what Bill just said is probably one of the most important distinctions a person needs to know to be an investor. Most people buy investments. So they buy mutual funds, they buy stocks, they buy real estate. But for those of you who read the book, I talk about the 90-10 rule. The 90-10 rule of investing in the 90-10 rule of money is 10% of the athletes make 90% of the money, 10% of the actors and actresses make 90% of the money, 10% of the authors make 90% of the money. There's a reason for that. In the world of investing, the reason that 10% of the investors make 90% of the money is because, as my rich dad said, the 10%, they know how to buy the investment, but they also know how to create the investment. So what Bill is saying here, he went from buying investments to actually developing his skill basis so that he could actually create the value. In other words, you could actually take something from nothing and make it extremely valuable, or take something that somebody ran into the ground and make it more valuable. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Robert. It's just being able to see. After time, you hone your skills and you can see the invisible. And you can see value that isn't seen to everybody else there, and you're able to extract that.
Right. You can see what other people cannot see. On our tape and financial literacy tape, which is the more advanced version of this educational process, Bill will go into some of the forms and information he gathers so that he can see what the average person cannot see. We're seeing the invisible, as he says. So what we're going to talk about today, one of the most important things between a good investor and a bad investor, I would say, is the invisible. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I think so. But yes.
I've often heard people say, well, you can't do that here. And you say, well, maybe you can't do that here, but I am doing it here. And you're doing deals all over the world, aren't you?
Yes, our firm has been involved in business. We're primarily a U.S.-based firm, but we've been involved in large transactions in Europe, and one of my partners has done deals all over the world. And so,
well, you and I were in Malaysia after the crash in 1997. We're looking around out there. Remember that one?
Well, we looked at that market very, very much, and it was interesting because we were there exactly as the market was in full blown erosion or deterioration. And on a daily basis, I was reading the newspaper, and I would tell these people, "I've seen this before. This is
the best time.
This was the United States when the RTC, which was the Resolution Trust Corporation, a branch of the federal government that came in to clean up our banking crisis, and I saw the same thing being created. And after that opportunity, it was created in Malaysia, it was created in Thailand,
Indonesia.
There were a number of other places that have had that, what I'll call, financial meltdown, and that opportunity existed. Our firm looked at it as actually going over and taking advantage of it, and we just made the decision not to do it because we had better opportunities or different opportunities
in America.
But other larger U.S. firms jumped all over that opportunity, and they'd seen it before, and they wanted to do it again, and they made huge profits.
In fact, Japan was one of the biggest targets there because the banking industry was so unregulated or so controlled that many, many U.S. companies went in there and actually started breaking up the large Japanese controllers just because they were going down. The reason I bring all this up is because Bill and I were in Malaysia teaching investing, and in our class we actually had people crying and sobbing because it was going down, and you and I were trying to tell them, if you can just change your attitude, change what you're seeing right now, you can actually see that this is the best time to be in the market. And for most people, all they do is they have the buy, hold, and pray mentality. They buy something, they hold it, and they pray the price always goes up. And they're not able to withstand the drop and realize that when it's dropping, it's also a different kind of opportunity. Would you agree with that one?
Well, I think definitely. I think that, there are markets that drop that aren't going to come back.
Right.
But I think that you have to look at the intrinsic value in a location. In my case, it was Austin, Texas, but Malaysia would be just as good an example. You'd have to look at the underlying economics of Malaysia, and you'd say to yourself, is Malaysia still going to survive and thrive into the 21st century? And I think the answer, when we were there 2 years ago, was clearly yes, it was going to, and it is
coming back strong.
And when that happens, that's when opportunities created. And if you had money before and lost some, it's a time to double back up and get back in the game. If you didn't have any, you weren't harmed by the collapse anyway, and so it's just a time to get into the game.
That's correct. So the most important thing, as listening to this tape, people ask me, how do you do it? How do you do it? And what we say to people, or they say, you can't do that here. Because the reason they can't do that is because they can't see what we're doing. Because most of it is going on in the invisible, inside the way we think, the way we act. And a lot of it's just the attitude. And if you can listen to this tape and understand our attitude is that markets go up and markets go down, and we really quite enjoy the game. Would you agree with that one?
Yes. I mean, it's to me an opportunity on either side of the market to make money. You just have to look for your niche or your opportunity in each particular market. And in our case, we've now gotten to the level of sophistication that we can choose markets, and we've kind of moved with the market. As one market's moving the wrong direction, we'll go to a different marketplace that may be moving a little more in our favor. But I think that's certainly not necessary to continue to have great investment results. And I have friends that have stayed in one market and one over time, and they've done very, very well with it. And in many cases, that's much simpler.
Good. So what we're going to be going into today is for the person starting out, like Bill started off with a $42,000 little duplex. I guess that would first investment property, was it?
It was actually a single-family house.
$42,000 single-family house.
Yeah.
High rent neighborhood. But that's how you start. And on the financial literacy tape, you'll be going into, as I say to people, is if you want to become an investor, you have to understand the vocabulary, which is financial literacy. Because I always say to people that the English language is filled with approximately 2 million words. Each of us has command of about 5,000 of those words. And if you want to be rich, the way you start is by understanding the vocabulary of the words. And on the more advanced tape, Bill will be going, the financial literacy tape, he'll be going into his due diligence checklist. Because due diligence is another way of saying fiduciary. And fiduciary means you're responsible, that you are responsible. So the reason I invest with Bill is because his integrity is high, his honesty is high, and his fiduciary responsibilities, in other words, how well he protects my money and gets my money back to me. I trust him implicitly on that. So on the financial literacy tape set, he'll be going into his more advanced checklist or due diligence checklist. But right now what we're talking about is how to get started, the basics. And for those of you who read my second book called The Cash Flow Quadrant, I wrote in that book about a friend of mine who had done over $1 billion in real estate transactions. And one day I went to Texas and I saw him actually teaching a class for his network marketing downline. And up until that point, I was very, very closed-minded to network marketing. And it was Bill Shopoff was the guy I was writing about. And I said, here's this guy who's a multimillionaire working with people on how to build a network marketing business. And my prejudices were sort of shattered at this moment, because here's a guy who's smarter and richer than me, you know, actually standing in a room of 30 people talking to them about how to build a network marketing business. So would you mind saying what was in your heart at that moment? I mean, you didn't really need to build the business, but what were you doing?
Well, there's a couple of things that motivated me. One of them is I like to go out and reach people. I like to go out and work with new people, and it was an opportunity to really get me out there and put myself in front of a large group of new people and expand my network. And my real estate business has always been driven off of a network, so it seemed like a natural fit to go into a network marketing opportunity. And I was also intrigued by network marketing per se as a business opportunity, and just wanted to go learn a little bit about it. Rather than make judgments about it, the best way was to go out and try to learn a little bit about it. We looked at it and said, how do we expand our group of our core investors for our real estate business? And we felt like the best way to get those people was to help them create it for themselves, and that's to create what in the United States is called an accredited investor status, and that's investors who make more than $200,000 a year.
That's a very big point here. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, defines the accredited investor as an individual who earns more than $200,000 per year, or has a net worth of over $1 million. So the investments, when lots of people say, well, can I invest with me? I say, well, I give my money to Bill Shopoff. The problem is they can't give their money to Bill Shopoff because they're not accredited investors. They don't make enough money. So that's really what opened my eyes to what was really going on in the world, is that one of the reasons the rich get richer is the rich have better investments to get into, the more exciting, should I say, than just buying a few stocks here and there. So you were doing that to develop people to come have enough extra cash flow, as well as educate them into the world of investing so that they could invest with you. Is that correct?
Well, absolutely. And I think that, you know, anything that we can do, a big part of our motivation of our real estate business and our investment company has been that we want to give back to others by helping them create wealth and cash flow for themselves. And the network marketing business was another opportunity to do that. And obviously it had some self-serving benefit to us, is that if we created people with high cash flow and high net worth, they'd come back around and invest with us.
Right. The reason I bring this up is because so many people come out to me, and on television we all see it, is how to buy real estate for nothing down. And so I hear people come out and say, can I buy something for property with nothing down? And the reason they're saying that, the reason they're looking for a nothing down property, is they have nothing to put down. And that's really quite tragic. And we do nothing down deals, but we don't have to do them also. I think those are very big distinctions. Do you have the money to put down, even though it's a nothing down deal? And I think the stats are, I think 80 to 90% don't have the money to put down. Would you say that that's true?
Well, I would say at least that. It could be higher than that, don't have it to put down. I mean, you know, most people are focused primarily on just getting shelter, on buying a house. And so they're certainly not focused on getting an investment property. And, you know, as Robert said, I mean, we do nothing down deals, but we don't go out and seek those out. We seek out to do deals that kind of fit the conventional format. And by looking for those deals, you find the nothing down opportunities. I think if you just went and looked for nothing down opportunities, it's just like having blinders on and you've limited what you can see. It's a much smaller universe of deals.
So. And one of the main reasons I buy real estate is because I'm primarily a businessman. And Bill Shopoff is really the real estate investor. So he's, you know, what we talk about is that investors have a team of people around them. And Bill is definitely part of my team. He and his wife, Cindy, are part of my team. And my job is through my businesses is to make the money. If you understand the tax laws almost require me to buy more real estate. They force me. They say, you must go buy more real estate. So, and I'm focusing on building my businesses. So I call Bill up and say, what you got? And he says, I got this. And I ship some money over to him and I focus on what I'm doing, which is building my businesses. Too many times I meet people who come over to me and they have nothing. They don't have a business. They barely have a job where they're struggling in the small business or self-employed arena. And it's really hard to get ahead from that way. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I mean, if you haven't mastered kind of the first step of the cash flow formula, and that's having your assets greater than your liabilities, the rest of it gets somewhat challenging. It's not to say that you can't make that next step without getting your first step all in order, but it is almost a one-step, two-step process.
Right. And for those of you who are just now getting the cash flow game, just in from straight accounting practice, there's three different types of income. There's earned income, there's passive income, and there's portfolio income. Earned income is income that's from wages or working labor. Passive is real estate primarily 80% of the time, and portfolio income is paper assets, stocks, bonds, and mutual fund. And the reason I like real estate is, number one, it's a very secure investment if you buy well. And number two is passive income, which is income generated off the asset, is the least taxed money. So what I'm constantly doing is I focus on my business, which produces earned income to me, and I call Bill up and I put my money into my real estate deals, which generate me passive income. And that passive income then buys my liabilities. And that's the formula that I have used over years. So instead of getting poorer and poorer, I get wealthier and wealthier because my asset base keeps going up, but so does my earned income as well as my passive income as well as my portfolio income. And so that's what this game cash flow, which Bill helped develop. He has an accounting and finance background. It's a very important game for those who are getting started. It's a fundamental. Would you say that's true?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, I think to me, it's understanding, you know, a basic income statement and balance sheet, and that's what cash flow helps people to learn. I've played it with a number of people who really weren't sophisticated, weren't smart investors, played it with my kids and friends of ours and their families. And, you know, I've seen people really get it by practicing this game. It's a great tool.
Thank you. And then the other part is that we talk about kids having an easier time with the game because they don't have any one way of doing things yet. They have multiple, they're more flexible, right?
Well, kids haven't gotten to that you can't do it here rule.
Right.
They have no rules about investing. And so, you know, I'd say 50% of the time that I go play that game, if we play it with kids, one of the kids is the winner of that game. It's not me, the 20-year career investor. It's some kid who just he's fast
having
and
fun.
he's having fun.
He doesn't have, this is the way I have to do it here. And one of the purposes of the game is to teach you multiple financial strategies, not a single financial strategy. And the single financial strategy that most people have is get up and go to work and pay your bills and put some money in your retirement plan. And that's a very slow plan of getting. I mean, you may never reach it. You may never get rich with that plan. So cash flow is just designed to have you think. Each time you play the game, you'll see, learn something new, because repetition is how we learn. And as Bill said, the more you teach it, the more you learn also. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I just enjoy playing and learning myself. And the more I teach, the more I learn, little distinctions, little nuances about my own investing style and investing skill set.
Right, it's a reflection of who you are at that moment, right? I mean, it's like, I've been doing this, I can try something new today.
Yeah. I have, you know, certain routines after 20 years of doing this. I get into habits, and not all of my habits are good habits. And so the game allows me to look at those habits and my patterns and possibly refocus my efforts and refine them into a higher skill set.
Good. So the reason I spent so much time on Bill, his background, and the way he thinks is because that's called an internal attitude, his skill sets, and how he looks at the business or the game of acquiring and buying and selling real estate. And like I said, on financial literacy, we go into more advanced due diligence checklists and things like this. So if you were talking to somebody right now about real estate, what would the five things you would say are very important for them to begin or get started in the business of acquiring real estate as an investment?
Well, the first thing I would do would be to create a plan, which would be to essentially set criteria or rules by which you want to invest.
If I could say that, it's probably the most important things I say in my third book, Rich Dad's Guide to Investing. Investing is a plan. And the reason I say that is my wife and I, when I decided that now that I'm married, I better play the game straight and put what I know into action and actual assets. I remember the first property we bought, it was a $46,000 two-bedroom house, really beautiful, little gingerbread house that Grandma would live in. It was beautiful. But after we bought it, and it was a what we call a blind assumption and all the wonderful things that make an investment so good, a great neighborhood. We were at the end of the month putting $25 in our pocket. And I remember she and I sitting there going, we did all this work, we spent all this time, we finally bought the first investment, and all we're making is $25. And there were some months when the tenant walked out, we were actually losing about $500 that month. We got another tenant in, and then the dishwasher would break, and we were doing this. And at first, we sat there going, my goodness, it's not worth it. You can't get rich on one little place, and that's true.
Absolutely. It's really of my five steps, that would really be my step six, is keep going in the game.
Right.
Is if you decide to invest in real estate, get in and get committed to it. One house is not going to give you, your retirement nest egg.
But it gives you good fundamentals at this point.
It gives you the fundamentals. It gives you a learning opportunity. The first house that I talked about, we paid $42,000. Three of us split it, and I think we split, about $50 cash flow between the three of us. And then we sold the property on a seller carry back note, which we ultimately foreclosed. I mean, we learned a lot of things in that first deal. And I think I invested $1,000 and made $2,500. So it wasn't a bad deal, but probably not worth a lot of my time. But what I learned was the fundamentals. And if I'd stopped after that house and said, it wasn't worth making, $1,500, $2,500, whatever it was that we made on that house, that there were easier ways to make that, I would have foregone the opportunity that I've had for the last 20 years to create real wealth in the real estate business.
Right. Because your wealth is actually your knowledge.
Yes, it's a matter of converting what I now know to action.
Right. So the thing I want to say about that first house, what kept us going is my wife and I had a plan. And our plan, we had just recently been married, and our plan was we were going to buy two houses a year for 10 years, hold them, and in 10 years, we would have 20 units. If I didn't have that plan guiding us, we would have quit. It was like, there's got to be a better way to make some money. And what happened eventually is we achieved our plan not in 10 years, but in 18 months. Because as Bill says, that first one we learned a lot from. Second one we learned even more from. Third one was even better. And the fourth one, we were almost geniuses at that point, and we knew the neighborhood, and we were running around and all this. And we also followed the second part of the plan, which is from the game Monopoly. You buy four greenhouses, then you buy a red hotel. And suddenly we started converting these little four greenhouses into apartment houses. And suddenly our wealth was just accumulating at such a high rate of speed that the real estate market was crashing exactly the same time Bill and I met. And we were talking about what he was doing. He was giving me information. And we're buying more and more. And every time we got some, we convert them into a bigger apartment house and increasing our asset column. So that's why a plan is very, very important to start, because just one deal is priceless, but it doesn't make you much money oftentimes.
Yeah, I think that very few people are going to be satisfied that one house is going to get you where you want to go on net worth or cash flow or any of your financial goals. But I think it is the stepping stone. And from that stepping stone, you know, for Robert, it was taking houses and moving them into apartment buildings. For us, it was similar. I mean, we bought duplexes. We ultimately converted those into apartment buildings and then self-storage units. We've gone on to acquire office buildings, shopping centers, and subdivisions. And our business is very broad. I tell people that we've bought everything from bowling alleys to church buildings, and it really didn't matter to us what it was. We were just really looking for how can we best make money for us and our investors out of this next opportunity.
Right. If I could bring something else back, is today I don't really buy any more property. Yet that plan of buying those little houses was priceless because it gave me some basic experience. I actually went to I bought one of those infomercial real estate classes, and I studied the thing, and I actually, in my 20s, and I like buying and selling real estate. But after we understood how to buy and sell real estate, that allowed me to talk to Bill Shopoff more intelligently. So if we can understand that today, I don't really want to buy my property. I don't really want to manage it. I'd rather call Bill up and say, Bill, I got $100,000. Do what you want with it. But it comes because he and I now have a commonality of understanding language, vocabulary, what's important, what's not important. So we speak the same jargon, per se. Would you say that's true?
Yes, and I think that's important. And I think what's important is if you don't understand the jargon, you just merely have to ask. I'd say that most people in my business or any other investment business are a little guilty of using, you know, internal lingo, internal dialogue. We have ways that we know how to communicate with one another without saying the whole words, and we shorten it up into a series of acronyms and cryptic messages that
outsiders can't understand.
You know, they're designed to confuse in some regards, and they're also designed just to make our lives simpler because we know what it means. But I think that one of the tips I would give people is, if you don't understand what somebody's saying to you,
ask them.
People aren't going to be offended by that, and if they are, you're probably meeting with the wrong advisor anyway. You need to find somebody that's willing to work with you at your skill level.
Right. So the part I want to go on with my plan here, my plan was to buy those four greenhouses, convert to red apartment houses, the hotels, and we got enough of that so my wife would never have to work again. We had our passive income higher than our expenses. But the secondary part of the plan was go back to what I like doing best, which is building businesses. Now that I trust Bill implicitly, but not that I trust him only, I trust myself because I understand what Bill is doing. I understand what property management, EPA laws, I understand his business. So when he and I were in Malaysia, I wasn't planning on buying any of those properties, but I was willing to give Bill the money to buy those properties. So part of my plan, as far as my development in real estate investment, because the tax laws are written for real estate guys, really, is to improve my education so that I had the sophistication to talk to people like Bill and Cindy Shopoff. So that was really part of my plan. It was a very long-term educational plan, and part of that plan was learning to be an investor by myself until I realized I don't really want to do this anymore. I just want to go make the money and let somebody else do what they're really good at. So that was definitely a long-term plan that went far beyond buying one two-bedroom house in Oregon.
Yeah, I think that's very important, is that not everybody is going to want to make a career out of being a real estate investor. But I think that getting into it, getting started, learning it, will give them a much greater skill set where they can choose professionals to guide them when their regular business, their regular earned income, or their passive income they've created from their first investments gives them an opportunity to play at a larger scale.
Right. Very, very important. It was part of my ability to choose my team around me. I had to do my share to be part of that team, which is my education first. So what is step two?
Well, step two, you really just walked right into it, because to me it would be to create a team. It would be to create the team of people that are going to support me in making my investment. And probably number one on that team would be to seek out a friend or a mentor who is going to advise me and guide me in my investment process.
Isn't part of your team Cindy, your wife?
Well, absolutely. In my case, it's...
And in my case, too. The reason I say that is oftentimes the husband or the wife does the investing only. And I want to say for Bill and I, what we have in common is Cindy is as important. I mean, I talk to Cindy more than I talk to Bill many of the times because Cindy is, in many ways, more knowledgeable in certain areas of the business. Isn't that true?
Well, I think she's more knowledgeable. She's more knowledgeable from an operating sense of the business. I think the other thing is Cindy probably is a more skilled communicator than me.
The same as my and for myself, too, is Kim actually is the major linchpin in my team, because without her, Bill knows that nothing would happen. He's seen me enough in 10 years now. He's known that I'm not the best at it. So I want to stress that very important part of the team is your family, your spouse, and the people around you, to make sure that they understand where you're going. And I think when families don't have that in common, I think it causes division. Education has ability to include, it can also exclude.
Yeah, I think if one person in a relationship decided they wanted to go seek this path and the other wasn't on it, there's potential for problems. And I just think it's easier to work together as a family. I think that we include our kids in our conversation. My 8 and 9 year old boy and girl know the properties that we own. They've been with me to buy properties. We drive by properties, and they get it now. At 8 or 9 years old, they understand, you know, that when we own a shopping center, that those people pay us rent, and that's how they buy their Game Boy or their
Nintendo.
Well,
tell them you own the video store that they rent. You own the building that the video store is in, right?
Yeah, my son, the first time we drove by one of the shopping centers, my son looked at it, and there was a brand name video store in there, and he said, well, does that mean that we get to get video games whenever we want, or video or movies? And I had to explain to him, no, Nick, they pay us rent, and then we have to pay them rent if we want a movie. And so now whenever we drive by the shopping center, he nudges one of his friends who's in the car with him, and he says, we own that place. And then he explains the whole financial model to
him. How old is he today?
He's 9 years old today.
Imagine what's going to happen. You project that out 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I think he's got a level of financial literacy at 9 that I did not have.
That's right. So the point I make here is this, is that, you know, money is an integral part of the family. It buys food, puts roof over their heads, and all this. And for my wife and I, and for Bill's family, it actually binds us closer together. Would you say that's true?
Yes, we've really, you know, grown. I mean, the fortunate thing for me is that when Cindy and I got together, neither of us really had great economic wealth. I mean, we've both kind of come out of a very tough real estate market as well as other personal issues. And when we got together, we really just decided we were going to build this together. And we have built it as a team.
Thanks. So the next part is the mentor.
And for me, that has been going out and looking for a person or people who know more about what I'm doing than what I do,
or have been down the path a couple of years ahead of you.
They've been there and
done that,
and they can explain to me, and they'll take you under their wing, so to speak. And I find that the people are very willing to do that. And in my case, mentors have taken a number of different peoples.
Right.
You know, I mean, in many cases, you, Robert, have been a great mentor of mine and a great teacher and taught me skills that I didn't know at the time and continue to reinforce those that did.
Thank you. And vice versa. That's been great.
You know, in others, you know, I've had people mentor me who didn't know near what I knew about the real estate business, but they knew a lot about business and they had a lot of business and investing wisdom. And I had one of my greatest friends and mentors. It was an elderly gentleman, just passed away right before New Year's this last year, and it's a great loss to me. But you know, at the same time, I revel in the friendship that we had for the last 8 years, and that he really was there by my side as I built my company. And you know, when I started it, I had very little, and he invested with me and kind of taught me and guided me. And at the same time, I was teaching him and guiding him in things that he didn't know. It was a great relationship to have. In many ways, you know, replaced, you know, some of the things that the relationship that I had with my father.
Right. And that's what my rich dad was for me and some of my friends. I always, first of all, when I want to learn something, I read a book first so I understand some of the vocabulary, and then I seek out mentors who can teach me what I want to learn. It's a very important part of it. So who else is part of your team?
Well, I also have an attorney or a lawyer on my team. And, you know, an important thing for me there was to seek out somebody who knew, in my case, new real estate law, rather than going and taking my neighborhood family lawyer, who might be a very competent real estate lawyer, but instead of competent, I was looking for somebody who was highly skilled at that. And so I asked referrals. I asked other people in the real estate business, other investors, and ultimately, you know, interviewed two or three attorneys until I found somebody or now a series of attorneys that we work with in different localities that have different expertises. But also, as important as their expertise, were people that I could relate to.
Right. And they have also friends that know other people, too. I mean, they also network out.
Well, they network out, and, you know, now my attorneys are sources of investors for us,
right,
as well as they invest themselves.
Because after they've seen what you do, because they're insiders on what you're doing, they can now, with confidence, recommend it to their friends.
Absolutely. Right. And also, we would have... you know, I'd recommend that you have an accountant or a CPA on your team. You know, real estate is
number driven.
It's number driven. It's also could be a tax advantaged investment if you do it properly. I mean, we invest in real estate for cash flows. We don't let taxes drive it, but we certainly like to make the best of a tax situation in what we do.
That's a very good point that Bill just said, to interrupt, is that a lot of people buy real estate because they want to defer the taxes or shelter taxes. It's something I generally would not do. Would you agree with that one?
Yeah, I think the real estate should stand alone as an investment, and then if you can enhance that investment by proper tax planning, I think that's a great strategy. But I think if you know, that's what we saw in the 80s was that real estate was driven by not paying taxes, so it was being supported by high
income.
That's
why it crashed.
Yeah, it was being supported by high income earners who didn't make cash flow from property. They were trying to shelter other cash flows.
It was called negative cash flow in Australia. It's called negative gearing. Yeah. A lot of people sell it. Say, well, buy this building so you can lose some money.
Yeah, we would. You know, that's a totally backwards thinking because then you become a slave to your real estate. You have to keep working so you can save tax money by owning real estate.
Right. And when I'm in Australia, I always talk about in America, we had this thing. They were selling it to all these doctors, lawyers, accountants, all the high-income people saying, buy property to lose money because you get a tax advantage on it. And basically what they were saying was give the government a dollar and they get 30 cents back. And it really made no sense to me at the time. And when they changed the tax law in 86, that's when that whole thing came down like a house of cards.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it just massively dropped values across America.
And savings and loans went broke, banks.
You know, the cost was literally hundreds of billions of dollars. And we still encounter sellers today, partnerships that were these tax-driven partnerships, and now they have a serious problem. They have a property, an older property that may need major repairs or maintenance, and they've got a tax problem in that their loan is greater than their tax basis. And so if they sell, they owe money because they're going to have to pay back that tax loss that they got 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
So in many cases, if by letting the what I'll call the tax train drive the money train rather than vice versa, these people have gotten themselves in a trap. And so I think, you know, for me, really remembering core basics, which is this is an economic investment followed by some tax planning.
That's correct. The thing I found in Bill being having an accounting degree and finance degree, a very sophisticated word in the finance world is the word cash flow. And the average person oftentimes, if it's profitable, we make sales and stuff. But cash flow is actually one of the most important driving forces. I mean, people buy things before the cash flow. Cash flow is very, very important. So for me, what Bill is saying about real estate is I'll buy a property for the cash flow, or what he was saying, can I create the asset to increase in value, i.e. throw off more cash flow, then he'll buy it. What the average investor does is they oftentimes buy it for the tax advantage, or they'll say something like, I hear this all the time, oh, I'm going to buy it for $100,000, and in 10 years I'm going to sell it because the price is going to go up. In other words, they're just hoping the market or inflation carries the value of the property. And Bill and I have both seen that property values go up and come down. So the thing we're talking about here is that the need to be a little bit more sophisticated than just doing what the average investor does, which is buy, hold, and pray, and to say, well, real estate goes up every year 5%. That's an assumption. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it goes down also. But what Bill is saying, he has the mental skills and the experience and the education to improve the value, to improve that cash flow. Would you say that's true?
Yes. You know, we do that in a number of ways, and you know, each property type and each property opportunity is different. I mean, it might be doing
right.
What we call value enhancement through just, you know, either cosmetic or major repairs. It might be putting different tenants in the property. Some of the value that we create is just through the way we finance a project. Oftentimes, the particular financing that we would put on would create, you know, substantial value. You know, 2 years ago, when mortgage rates were low in the United States, we were able to put long-term fixed-rate assumable financing on our properties that now has created very substantial value, that we have 7.5% mortgages in a 9% mortgage market.
What that means, the expense of his money has gone down substantially, which means it's more profit, which makes the building more valuable.
More valuable. So the next investor that we sell to, he'll pay us a premium for that mortgage.
Right. So what's number three?
Number three to me would be to determine exactly where. Now, you've got a plan. You want to buy so many houses or so many duplexes. It's to decide exactly where you want to do that, you know, I would look at that both in a macro and a micro term, which is, do I want to concentrate just in the town that I live in? Do I want to broaden that? And I think, you know, for just getting started, I'd recommend that people just start, you know, probably locally or at least in one town. It might not be in the town they live in, but I would probably look in one marketplace, and then I'd go to what I'd call a more micro look, which is I'd start looking at neighborhoods, and I'd start deciding which specific neighborhoods I think have the greatest opportunity.
Right. For me, it was jogging a 15-block area. So I became the expert in that one little area. So I knew values, I knew rents, I knew who was in there. I could see things going up and coming down. So it's really to look very, very, dream big but think small, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's when you've decided this, you know, this area, then you start gathering data, which is part of the step, which is gathering data on that area so that when a good investment comes along, you'll know that it's a good investment. If you haven't done any research on it, literally, they could, as the expression is, you know, if it came along and bit you, you wouldn't know it. And in many cases, I see people who come to me and they're dragging along an investment opportunity in hand, and they really don't know whether it represents a good opportunity or an average opportunity, and until they have a little training or have taken the time to go research a marketplace.
Which is why I started this whole thing with my first meeting Bill when the market had crashed and had wiped out his own financials. But because Bill had been in the business prior to the crash, he had enough experience to realize good and bad deals. And actually, because of his experience, he saw that the real estate market wasn't bad. It was actually at its best because it was so low. Would you say that's true?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, we looked at it and said that there's just great core value here. And so now we need to determine how we're going to capture that value.
And the other part I always hear people say is, well, you know, they offered me that deal, but I passed it up. And it's that would have, should have, could have.
Well, I'm an expert at that, Robert. So,
me too.
You know, I mean, having been in a great market and capitalized on it to a large extent, but it's very easy to sit there and second guess myself and say, God, I wish I'd bought more and more deals. And you know what?
About this? You and I sat in town where Michael Dell was coming up. And if we were really that smart, we should have been buying more Dell stock at that time rather than real estate. But all we could do was what we knew at that time. Is that correct?
I knew real estate. I didn't know Dell Computers. I knew it to be a great company, but I certainly didn't have the projection that it would do what it did for its shareholders over the last decade, being the, you know, I think literally the number one stock in the market for the 1990s.
So we were in the woulda, shoulda, coulda, but the thing is we stayed focused on what we had to do.
But what we did do is we invested in a town that has been driven by Dell Computers. And so we've, you know, although I didn't own Dell stock in the 90s, what I did own was other properties whose stock was rising because of Dell, because jobs were being created and
shopping centers,
you know, office buildings were being built and occupied by spin-off businesses from Dell, that we got an ancillary benefit by being in that town.
So the point I want to bring up here is this. I meet so many people who want to invest, but they never focus. They chase the hot deal. And if you're chasing the deal when it's hot, you're always late. Would you say that's probably true?
Yeah, by the time I've heard that a market's good,
you're late.
You know, it's already good. Right. I mean, the smart money's already into the market. There may still be opportunities there, but they're not the above average opportunities. You know, not to get too technical, but for many have seen a risk return curve, risk reward curve. And, you know, what we're trying to always look for is things that we think are kind of off that curve a little bit, where
opportunities,
where we can create a higher return relative to risk.
So you have control over what the asset does. People who just buy stock hoping it goes up, you don't have much control because the market's running that most of the time. And what I'm saying is that the person that makes the most money often has more control over the creation of the value of that asset.
Yeah, if we've done our homework on a particular market and all the what I'll call demographic figures are good, that, you know, employment is on the increase and population is increasing. Those are the kind of the core things that drive real estate values. And they're fairly easy data to compile or obtain in probably virtually every market in the world that you can find that information. In some places it'll be easier than others. Some places it's just as simple as going to the internet. Others you might have to go to a city office and find out. You know, and you can find that information from a lot of places, the phone company in places, the electric company. You see how many people are hooking up, you know, new electrical service.
You know where I find it is in U-Hauls, how many U-Hauls are coming in and how many are going out empty.
Yeah, yeah, and I think those are all great, you know, every market's going to have a different indicator, and it is as simple as, you know, calling the U-Haul guy. It's as simple as calling,
sense.
You know, it's as simple as you know, you see the guy who's installing phones in your neighborhood and you ask him, you know, are you doing more than you did last year? You know, there are a lot of very easy ways to do this. So you don't have to have sophisticated methods. You just have to have a couple methods that you've determined give you reasonably accurate information and then use them.
What step are we on now?
4. And to me, 4 would be, you know, you've got a plan. You've got your team. You've decided, you know, what market you're going to go into, what location. And I think the next step would be, you know, getting a core idea of how you're going to finance whatever you go out and buy. You know, how much do I have? How much equity or cash do I have to put down? And the other question I would ask is, where can I get more? Could I
source of funds?
You know, do I have a friend, relative, acquaintance who, if I brought them a good opportunity, would go in with me so that I could stretch my investment dollars a little bit further and you know, maybe I see a great deal that's twice the size of what I have ability to do. Can I partner with somebody? And I think that's, you know, and it's talking to, you know, certainly on your team would have been a, you know, somebody in the finance or mortgage business.
They're called mortgage brokers.
Mortgage brokers or bankers. You know, and I would start to line up, at least in my mind, what financing would look like.
Before you need it.
Before you need it, you should know what's out there, because otherwise you're going to find this opportunity, and if it's a good opportunity, it's going to move quickly, and you're going to be fumbling around trying to figure out how to get
a co-signer, it's called.
Yeah. And I think it's better to have that. To me, that would be step 4, is line up how you're going to get there.
If I could, that's a very good point, is I would go talk to them also and ask them what is important to them, what forms, what files, what, you know, what makes it easier for them to do their job.
Yeah, so you could start, you know, if you need tax returns or W-2s, as it would be in the United States, or whatever your source of income verification
is.
But they'll give you, you know, a mortgage banker will have a list, and they'll hand it to you. Very, very simple. And you can start assembling that stuff as part of your process. And
it's a good education.
I was going to say, I think for most people, if they haven't already done that step, they're going to find that there's things in there that they need to do, because they're going to have to create a balance sheet and an income statement. And those are steps that probably should have been done some other point, but they clearly need to be done at this point.
In many ways, that's actually step 1.
Yeah. In many ways, it is. But I think for many of us, we might have skipped to step 4.
Yeah. And I've done that one.
And I think that it's kind of getting your financial house in order.
Right.
And I think it's a time to self-assess where you are.
Right. And this is a commercial message. We have a tape set called Your First Step to Financial Freedom. It's done with our accountant, Diane Kennedy. And it's really, as Bill says, putting your house in financial order. You know, creating and understanding a little bit of tax law and corporate law and all this. But step 1 really is, you really got to put your house in order. Otherwise, yeah, it's really hard to, even if you found a good deal, nobody would let you have it because they don't trust you.
Right. I mean, if you don't know the basic ways to get to the deal. So.
And that's what cash flow was created for, was so you had an understanding how an income statement and balance sheets work. The average person can barely balance a checkbook, which is far away from an income statement and balance sheet. So cash flow, by playing it repetitiously, you'll have a better control over the internal checklist in your brain as what's important, what's not important. And when you ask a banker or a mortgage broker and things like this, you'll be more in sync with what they're looking for, because they think the same things are important.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's one of the things of the importance of playing cash flow, I think, is that, you know, just that working that income statement and that balance sheet and the repetition of the numbers and being able to do it with speed and accuracy, and I emphasize accuracy because accounting is an accurate
it's business. Garbage in and garbage out.
Yeah, it is a place where to me, you know, it's balancing to the penny. You know, I used to not think that was critical, but to me it is critical because it really determines whether things are in sync or out of sync. And it's also an example of to me, how important your money is to you.
And your diligence, your due diligence. That's what we talk about all the time. The other part about a financial statement is when you're buying, let's say you have your financial statement, income statement and balance sheet, a piece of real estate also has income statement and balance sheet. Is that correct?
That's correct. And
a business has an income statement and balance sheet. It is so fundamental.
And we can talk about that a little bit more in the financial literacy series where we get into greater detail. But, you know, that is the core value of you know, of an income property, you know, of a house or a duplex or an apartment building is that income statement. And then to some extent that balance sheet is also very important. And many of us overlook the balance sheet, but there's a lot of hidden secrets in a balance sheet on real estate that we can teach people how to look at.
Right. So when people are buying a piece of income property, let's say, or a company or a business or whatever they're buying, the thing I'm doing is I have my personal financial statement, unless I'm going to buy a duplex. I'm looking at the financial statement of that duplex and then marrying it over my, so I'm comparing one upon the other, and what's the effect upon my finances if I acquire that financial statement? That's why financial literacy is so vitally important because, like, I don't like taking risks. I don't like losing money. Do you?
Absolutely not.
And by having the financials, you reduce your risk.
Yeah, you have to have the basic tools. And I think one of the things you're trying to figure out is that investment, the term is accretive. Does it add to your financial statement?
Does it fit?
You know, if you buy something that negative cash flows or negative gears $500 a month, and you didn't have $500 a month in your budget, you know, it doesn't matter if that doubles in value if you don't have the resources to carry it there.
Right.
So, you know, it's I'm not saying to never buy a negative cash flow
on
property.
Correct.
Absolutely not. But I'm saying if you haven't looked at your financial statement and put away the reserves to get you to the point which that point property would appreciate, then your investment is going to fall apart and unravel before, you know, it's matured.
Right. So what I'm saying, a financial statement, your personal, and an investment, let's say a house, is almost like a marriage. You're pulling two different financial statements together, and if they don't work, you have a major, in the relationship, it's called divorce. In business, it's called bankruptcy, or, you know, you go to court. And so that's why financial literacy is so important. People say investing is risky. I say not being financially literate is very, very risky because I don't like taking risks. I want to see how well is this deal is going to fit. Can I afford it? What's its upside? What's its downside? And what's its long-term effect to my asset column or liability column? Because an investment can be asset or liability, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there is risk in investing, but there's, to me, more risk in not investing.
That's correct.
In a market, even in the world that we're in today, which in the United States is a relatively low inflation market, even at low inflation, it does not equal no inflation, which means that my wealth is being eroded. If I stand still, my wealth gets eroded on a daily basis if I don't take action on it.
And if you don't take action, even if you make a mistake, you've also lost the time to learn something.
Yeah.
And that's why people who do nothing actually fall farther behind.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So what's step five?
Well, step five would be get out and buy something. It's actually take action.
Start small.
Start small. Start with something that you can understand and you can get your hands on.
That even if you lost a few dollars on it, it would be priceless. The loss would be priceless.
Yeah. As I said, you know, in the first deal we bought, we had all kinds of learning in it. You know, we sold it. We got it back in foreclosure. We sold it again. You know, we had all kinds of opportunities
to learn.
To learn. And, you know, some of those were, you know, we sold it and we expected to get money every month. And the next thing we knew, it was like a tenant leaving. We had to buy, you know, hire a lawyer to foreclose on it and spend $1,000 on a foreclosure. And, you know, there were great learning opportunities for us. They were very frustrating at the time. But every time I turned over a new leaf and I didn't know it at the time, that doing that foreclosure on that first house ended up becoming a whole business line for us. Because we ultimately did a business where that was a big part of our business opportunity.
Right, you went after people who weren't paying their bills.
Right, we bought mortgages at a discount, ultimately.
Because you could collect on them.
And we could collect on them. So I didn't know that when I did that $42,000 house and did that foreclosure, that someday that was going to actually be an entire business line for us. But it, you know, I learned something there that ultimately, you know, alleviated some of the fear of going into something that I didn't really know and understand.
So that was a priceless $42,000 investment.
Absolutely. And it, you know, it was a $42,000 purchase price. My investment was maybe $1,000 in it. So, you know, looking back, relative learnings, that was one of the best investments I've ever made.
So that's worth millions and millions of dollars today.
Absolutely. It's afforded me a fairly nice lifestyle and
freedom.
And great economic freedom today.
Right.
I mean, I'm at a point today where I would consider I'm financially free. So it is, you know, it's get out and take action, buy something, get out with your broker, get out, you know, on yourself, you know, read the newspaper, all of those things that it takes, and then take action, make offers. And don't be afraid to make low offers. You know, you make rational offers, but rational in your mind with what your plan is. You know, if brokers tell you, well, that's too low.
It's your money.
It's your money. Ask them, you know, are they buying it? Of course not. You know, they may own properties, but by and large, you know, they're just there to facilitate the transaction, and they don't set value. You know, the seller is going to set the value, and you know, the broker may or may not know, but generally, you know, each seller has different motivations, and I've seen sellers in really great markets sell for below, you know, the quote-unquote market value. They wanted to sell today.
Because you don't know why they want to sell it.
We, in fact, have been sellers just like that. There are days we may have a better opportunity, and even though the property might be worth $100,000, we'd sell it for $80,000 so we could put the money into something that, you know, we could buy for $150,000 that was worth $300,000.
Right.
Nobody knows until you ask. So there's no harm in asking.
Right. You know, the thing that people say is that they do one deal and it goes bad, and then they stop real estate forever, or they buy a stock and then I'll never do that again. That's the scenario. In your mind, if you were to invest in 10 different properties, how many do you think would go bad and how many do you think would go good?
Well, I think at this point, I'm probably going to have a little higher ratio, but I can tell you that we would, out of 10 properties, we're going to still have one or two that are going to go bad. And for us, bad is that they're going to lose a little bit of money. You know, we might have one or two that break even. So, you know, out of 10, we might have 2 to 4 that don't make huge money or lose a little bit. And we're going to have 5 or 6 that do very well for us. It's a portfolio opportunity. I'm not so smart that I can make 100% good opportunities.
And that's what a lot of people are trying to do. They're trying to do one deal that is the home run.
Yeah, I used to have brokers that worked for me who also were investing on the side, and they would, you know, when I ran a commercial real estate brokerage operation, it had about 30 brokers working for me at one point. And, you know, these guys were always looking for the pot at the end of the rainbow. You know, it was that one deal that they could retire on. And, I mean, I have literally, my firm has bought in the last 8 years over 800 pieces of property, bought and sold. And I haven't gotten to that one deal at the end of the rainbow yet. I mean, what we do is we make a little bit of money on a lot of properties.
And you gain a lot of experience on a lot of properties.
A lot of experience, and a lot of it's repetition. You know, some of those were blocks of properties where we went and bought a lot of them at one time and we resold them. But, you know, we don't look for any one deal to make us rich. What we're looking for is each deal to add a little bit to our overall financial pie.
Thank you. So, Bill, before we end this tape, would you mind recapping the 5 steps you think that are very important for people who want to get started in this area of real estate investing?
Certainly, Robert. I think the 5 steps are, first of all, create a plan. Create an investment plan that you're going to follow. Second step would be create your team. As we said, there's a number of members of that team.
The team's always changing, too. It's evolving, isn't it?
Sure. As you're getting more sophisticated or choosing different property types, you can have different people on your team. You know, one broker that you work with might know where to find the best duplex deals, but he may or may not be the broker that you would use to buy an apartment building. So you always want to be flexible on that team.
And the same as accountants and attorneys, they have different specialties.
Certainly. And then, as I said, step 3 would be determining a location, determining exactly where you want to be making your investment, both in, you know, in what macro area in the city that you want to be in, or state or jurisdiction that you want to be in. And then as well, you know, specifically then get down to a neighborhood level of where you want to make those investments.
And that applies to stocks, bonds, and anything also. I mean,
yes.
That applies to anything.
Yeah, do you want to be in the
tech stocks?
Do you want to be in the tech stocks? Do you want to be in small cap, large cap? You want to buy on the, you know, mutual funds,
commodity trading,
or individual
futures.
Stocks. So there's, you know, that really does transfer from one to the other. Step four would be, how are you going to finance it? Specifically, if it's a real estate investment, you know, putting together, getting together with your mortgage banker and getting your financial house in order. How would you finance that first investment, or the second one, or third?
And a very important part of the financing is understanding the language. Like we were talking last night about recourse, non-recourse, and how important those little words are.
Yeah, those are very, very small words that have very material
long-term impact.
Long-term impact into your lifestyle. And then, as I said, step five is an action step. It's get out and make your investments. Make your offers and make your investment.
Right. Start small and dream big.
Yep.
So thank you. And before we go, I'd like to bring Cindy in because she's a very big part of your team. So, Cindy, welcome. And you'll be doing part of the advanced portion on financial literacy. But we're in the beginning part. And since you're a woman, obviously, would you mind giving, if you had any advice to women getting started in real estate, because you're a person I tremendously respect, and I look to you for information and advice on the market. What would you advise to women to get started?
Well, I have an interesting idea about this, Robert. I actually think that women who want to invest should seek other women out who are doing investing. Now, I would not limit myself to that, but I do believe that there is a commonality that can be shared by looking for that. As you know, Kim and I have, you know, created a great bond.
You and Kim are great friends because
yeah.
you have so much in common, not only as friends and golf, but also real estate. You guys know more than I do. It's kind of embarrassing at times.
Well, thank you. That's very complimentary. But I would say that would be one step. And I think I would make that the first step. The second step, I think I would go back to what you're saying at the beginning of the tape. Start getting information for yourself. Start reading books. Start looking around in the marketplace. And so start educating yourself. That would be the two main things.
Great. And on the advanced tape, the financial literacy tape, Cindy will be going into how to start gathering the information, which is so vitally important, so that once you gather it, then you can synthesize it and then make your decision. So, Cindy, thank you very much for not only being a friend, but being a major contributor to our business and to millions of people out there. So thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
So with that, Bill, I think it's been priceless, the insights you've brought to people just getting started in investing in real estate or any kind of investing. I think is the fundamentals are always there. As Bill and I, we always talk about, we have friends are assets and liabilities. You know, there's some people that cost you money, but there's also friends that make you money. And Bill's definitely one of my assets because everything I do with him makes money. So I'm thrilled with that. And I really thank you for being a humanitarian and wanting to teach other people. So thank you very much for this time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Robert. It's been a great pleasure to share with your audience.
Thank you. And for those of you who would like to have more information, a little bit more insight, more advanced types of investment, what we call due diligence or fiduciary responsibility, or what you look for, how do you make sure the deal is a good deal? That will be the financial literacy tape, and that may be the next step on your economic evolution. So thank you for listening to this part of the tape, which is part of Cashflow 101.
Thank you for listening to this tape. For additional information about Cashflow Technologies and Robert Kiyosaki, please visit our website at richdad.com.